Janice Tom, I'm 63 years old. Today is April 25th, 2019, and we're in New York, New York. And I am recording this with my colleague, Reese.
I'm Reese Rathjen. I'm 31 years old. Today is April 25th, 2019. We're in New York, New York, and I'm recording this with my colleague, Janice Tom. All right, so tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
I was born in Ohio, Southern Ohio. We lived in a little town called Chillicothe, which was too small to have a hospital, so I was born in Waverly. My dad was working for the Atomic Energy Commission at the Goodyear Power Plant. And the summer I turned five, we moved back, for my parents, back east, because my dad is a native New Yorker and my mom grew up in Connecticut. And grew up really in a very small town on the north shore of Long Island.
Okay. And what was it like to kind of start to understand yourself as a lesbian growing up there?
Well, you know, I didn't. I think that I was aware early on that, like, something was different, which I think most queer kids will tell you. But I didn't come out even to myself until, I'm going to say, this is going to sound a little pathetic, but probably graduate school. So I was away from home for college.
Mm-hmm.
Went to college in upstate New York, and then lived at home for a year in between figuring out what I was doing next, and then went to library school. I have a master's in library science from UNC Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that being that far away from home, being a little older, it gives you a certain kind of freedom, even in your own mind, maybe especially in your own mind. And I met queer people. You know, librarianship is pretty queer. My dad is a librarian, so it's not completely queer, but it's a pretty queer profession. And that was the point. I was certainly closeted, but I started to come out to myself. And then, you know, my first job after library school was actually back in North Carolina. Like, I moved all the way back to New York and ended up moving back to Charlotte, where I worked for IBM, where I was certainly in the closet. That was not safe, and I was that smart. But then ended up at a job in New York,
mm-hmm.
and moved to Park Slope, Brooklyn, which then was a pretty beat-up neighborhood that was being revitalized by lesbians who were buying these really cheap townhouses that were falling down and renovating them. And so there's a reason it was called Dyke Slope. Because we basically homesteaded the whole place and started having babies. And, you know, anywhere gay people go is suddenly too nice and they have to move out because it gets too expensive. I mean, it happens in artist communities all over the world, right? That's what happened to here to Soho. So living in Park Slope really allowed me to be out, at least in my non-work life. I was working at banks and brokerage firms, and I'm old enough, and that was long enough ago, that being out at work was not a possibility.
What years was that?
That would have been the mid-80s.
Okay.
Yeah, and it just, you know, it was cool to walk around holding your girlfriend's hand in those, like, five blocks in Park Slope.
Yeah.
But I worked for great big Fortune 10, Fortune 25 companies, financial companies, and I wore a suit and skirt and heels and hose to work every day. I loved those jobs. They were great jobs, but they were not jobs where it was safe to be out. So I wasn't.
Yeah. How long did you work in those kind of environments?
That's really interesting. Overall, I think the whole bank and brokerage firm thing was probably 10 or 15 years. I was a librarian. I was a special librarian. And that was back when people realized that not all information was on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And this didn't, you know, not everything on the internet is actually true. And so people actually had researchers do research that could, you know, make good investments. That doesn't exist anymore, she says with some annoyance. So, yeah, and then had a couple of, like, really weird jobs. They were research jobs, but they were basically boiler room jobs.
Uh-huh.
So, like, people have gave us so much money. All these big companies gave us a retainer every month, and they could call up and ask any question they wanted. And we had to go get the answer.
Okay.
It was a very strange job. But, you know, you could be whatever. You could have nearly come to work naked there as long as you answered the questions. They really didn't care. So that was the point at which I started having some gay friends at work. and slowly started to, you know, come out. I could at least be out of work.
Yeah.
And, you know, went from there to AMFAR, to the American Foundation for AIDS Research, where, you know, AIDS is not a gay disease, but it was certainly okay to be out at AMFAR.
Uh-huh.
And this is really collapsing my work life, but, you know, got hired away from there to the task force,
mm-hmm.
where actually being out at work is perfectly all right.
I would hope so.
Yeah, exactly. Gay for pay.
And I know that you did a lot with New York Pride over the years. Was that overlapping with your time working in those more conservative?
Yeah, it actually was. Yeah. There wasn't a huge overlap. Most of that happened after I got out of sort of the banking industry.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is that the first gay, really gay thing I did was I volunteered for what was in the National Gay Task Force,
mm-hmm.
When it was headquartered here in New York. At 85th Avenue, and we had the first 800 number, first gay 800 number of any kind, probably in the world, but certainly in the country. And it was specifically an AIDS hotline,
mm-hmm.
and it was when AIDS was called GRID, stood for gay-related immune deficiency.
Mm.
And people would call in, it was mostly at night, and there were like five stations. I was usually the only woman. And people would call in with questions that, you know, now sort of blow my mind. And we had answers that were terrible, but they were the best answers we had. Like, if you're not promiscuous, you're safe. Well, that's not true, but it certainly seemed like it then.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'd have people, but because we were the only 800 number, we'd also have kids calling in from phone booths in the middle of Florida saying, I came out and my parents kicked me out of the house, I don't know what to do.
Wow.
And they'd be like standing there with a quarter. And, you know, so we, you know, we'd find like some MCC in Palmetto, Florida, and say, there's this kid standing in a phone booth, can you go get him?
Wow.
And they would. So some of it had nothing to do with AIDS because we were it. We were the only thing there was. And I actually met my first girlfriend there. And when we broke up, we had friends on Staten Island in this organization called the Staten Island Lesbian Connection, which was silk. We thought that was so cool. And we marched in Pride one year. And this was when Pride ended at the river, and the rally was at the end of the march,
mm-hmm.
Which hasn't been true forever, and it's not true at all now. And you couldn't hear the rally, because the sound system was like, I don't know, a tin can with a string. And they called because I was one of the marshals, and they said, do you want to come to the thank you party? And I said, no, I don't, but you know, your sound system sucks. They said, would you like to work on it? I said, sure. And that is precisely how I got involved with Pride and worked on the rally and ended up on the board for almost 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing. I was actually the president of an organization that's now called InterPride, which then was called the International Association of Lesbian and Gay Pride Coordinators, which are all the pride organizations around the country and now around the world.
Wow.
And which is where I saw the quilt, because we moved our national conference to Baltimore in 1987. It was supposed to be, I think, in St. Louis.
The year I was born, for some
intergenerational
context.
I'm going to stab myself. And that was, they had the whole quilt out, and it literally covered them all.
Wow.
It literally covered them all. And, you know, you kind of came out of a noise and raucousness of, you know, the march and a zillion queer people being in one place and all the gay bands and all the gay choruses. And you walked into this huge open public space, open to the sky. I mean, it's not a building, it's a park. And it was as quiet as it could be. And it was covered with dust. And it was astonishing. And I think now I know what I was looking at, but I really don't think I knew what I was looking at. Because I was kind of, it was 87, I was still pretty young. And I hadn't yet had a friend who died.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of friends who weren't feeling well, and we weren't really sure why. But I didn't have any friends who had died yet. So it didn't make any sense to me. And because I didn't have anyone on the quilt yet. Now I do. But so it didn't make any sense to me, and I remember thinking, this is huge. I'm not really sure what this is, and then I went off and did something else. I have to admit, I did not pay enough attention to it. In 93, at that march, I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I was a member of, I don't know if they call it this anymore, but Heritage of Pride from probably 86 mm-hmm. to, I'm going to guess, 96 or 97. And held a bunch of positions on the board. I was co-chair three times because they fooled me. They didn't tell me that I was taking over someone's term, and I wasn't smart enough to figure that out. I was March chair for 3 years. That's the best job in the world. It is the best job in the world. To be able to stand and, I mean, to be able to put something like that together for everyone, because the deal is that here's the street, here are the toilets, you're in this order because that's what we think makes sense. After that, don't hurt anyone. Have a good time. We're going to try and keep you moving so the march doesn't take 7 hours. But, you know, be the biggest fag, the biggest fairy, the biggest butch you want to be as trans as you want to be whatever it is you want to do. Enjoy yourself, right? This is the one day where nobody's going to bother you. It's kind of like creating change.
Yeah.
Like it was the essence of be you. And, you know, to be able to be involved with a group of volunteers, because it's all volunteers, to make something that affirming happen, I could never regret a minute of it. And in 94, I think New York Pride did a dumb thing, and I think that they would admit it now, that mm-hmm. kind of gave away two parts of Pride to this nascent organization called Stonewall 25, mm-hmm. which I think got its 501c3 like moments before June of 94. And so the march and the rally that year weren't done by Heritage of Pride.
They did
the dance and took the opportunity to do it for two nights and made a boatload of money, which is great because that money carried us through for a couple of years, because it was a little dicey after that, because it's like, well, we just did this big thing and who are you people again? Right? And we did the Pride Festival, which I think was also much bigger and might have gone for 2 days. I don't remember anymore. But Stonewall 25, I was the representative from InterPride. But also as a New Yorker and as somebody who'd worked on Pride for a long time, a lot of the folks who were involved in it came in to work on it mm-hmm. from all over the country, which was great, but they had no idea what they were doing. I mean, to the point where they thought we could march up to the UN and make a right. And I'm like, you can't actually do that. You'll get really wet. and I don't think they're going to let all of us walk around the grounds of the UN. This was long before 9/11. You can't just like walk around the UN. Plus, it's not that big. He said, oh, we could meet in Doc Hammarskjöld Plaza. I'm like, it's like the size of your living room. We're going to have 2 million people here. You won't be able to fit anything but the lead banner in there. So there was a lot of that. A lot of, you know, New York realness had to be delivered. So I worked on that, and it was a bunch of amateurs. There was no fundraising. But this is also when the only sponsors a queer thing could get was like beer and cigarettes, or liquor and cigarettes. And we wouldn't take cigarette money. You know, one of the first sponsorships I got at Heritage of Pride was from Bud, right? And they gave me a check for $10,000, and I thought this was the most money we'd ever have. I thought it was astonishing. So, you know, Stonewall 25 sponsors there weren't any. Mm-hmm. And so we were building the rally stage on the Great Lawn, and we had, you know, a big professional company doing it, and every once in a while they just quit because we couldn't pay him.
Wow.
And, you know, we'd scramble for 3 or 4 hours and, like, scrape up whatever it was they needed to get going again. And they quit again. I didn't think we were going to have a rally because I didn't think, like, the sound was going to be up.
Wow.
And it was this massive concert stage because the Great Lawn is huge, which is why they call it that. So we filled Fifth Avenue. There was actually a counter march. The Stonewall 25 march actually went by the UN. It went down First Avenue,
mm-hmm.
up First Avenue. To the Great Lawn,
mm-hmm.
and there was a counter march because they didn't want to go past the UN. Of course there was, and I think there's going to be one this year too, that went up Fifth to the Great Lawn, and they just met at the Great Lawn, and it was actually fun. It was very, the folks who were working on the official march were actually, the New Yorkers were totally cool with the march on Fifth Avenue. It's like, yeah, we'd actually rather be there.
Mm-hmm.
So good, take up the space, keep the space for us, we'll be back. And yeah, it was That was an amazing thing. And it, you know, it ended deeply in the red. It ended with all of these people we owed money to. And, you know, we ended up just declaring bankruptcy.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, my friend Franklin, who was one of the national co-chairs at the age of 29, I think he ended up losing, I mean, this doesn't sound like a big deal now, but he ended up losing his American Express card because we had put, like, everything on it, and he couldn't pay it, and so American Express took it away. So stuff like that happened.
Wow.
Yeah. It was kind of amazing. But, you know, after that, went back to working on Pride. I was the chair for the Dance on the Pier for 3 years. I was the person who started the Women's Dance on the Pier, which used to be called Rapture. I think they've renamed it.
Mm-hmm. When did you start that?
Oh, man. I don't even know. It would have been maybe 90. Feels like it might have been... No, that can't be right. It's almost 25. Huh. It must have been, the like, 96 or 97. That sound right. Yeah, that might be right. Because the last thing I did as a board member was the dance, and I did it for 3 years because, again, they fooled me. I'm like, no, we'll get somebody to do it. And nobody wanted to do it. I'm like, all right, I'll do it again. You know, and while the march, I think, was the most meaningful thing I did, you know, to be able to say, well, at one time in my life, I actually got to say go and all these fireworks lit up the sky. That's pretty cool. Not many people get to say that. You know, and I got to get Janet Jackson on stage, and, you know, I got to get, now I can't think of her name, Jennifer Lopez up on stage. She is about 37 pounds wringing wet.
Wow.
You just can't imagine how tiny she is. So, you know, it made all those boys happy. So that's the Pride, that's a short tour of the Pride thing.
So, your life has been a lot of different things.
Yes.
Yeah. What did you imagine as a young librarian that your life would be?
Not this.
And how is it different?
That's really interesting. You know, one of the things I wanted to do when I was in library school is be president of the American Library Association, which is the professional association. One of them. There are several. And I rapidly realized that wasn't actually all that interesting to me. For one thing, it was always men. Now, not true anymore, which is really fascinating because most, like the vast majority of librarians are women,
mm-hmm.
or female identified people. But if you look at big library systems, like big cities or huge universities, or things like the American Library System, all the people who are running those are guys.
Wow.
And most of them don't have library degrees. They have MBAs, which I could see that being useful, but they don't have library degrees. And I could get off on a whole thing about how unfair that is. But I didn't imagine this. Now, my family was very invested in what we now call social justice, what they would have called civil rights. And so I was brought up with that. During the Vietnam War, my dad went to Washington every month to march. And he wanted to take me, and my mother said, I think she's a little young, which was probably true. I don't think he could have managed like a 12-year-old who needed to pee. when he was with all his buddies. But so that was important. You know, my first sort of piece of political knowledge had to do with Pete Seeger, who was one of my family's icons, that he wasn't allowed to perform. He'd been blacklisted. And the reason was that he was a communist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he testified in front of the Joe McCarthy's commission, and he wouldn't answer any questions. He said, they'll sing for you. So, you know, that, I grew up with that, you know, and I grew up with stories about people like Paul Robeson and Leadbelly and Martin Luther King and Elizabeth Cotton and people who were part of the culture of the civil rights movement and the culture of this country, because my parents were all both first generation Americans. So all of the fact that I ended up doing this kind of social justice work and got to it through Pride, it's a surprise, but it's really not. And, you know, my mother passed away before I got involved with Pride, and actually while I was still working for banks, which, you know, they were both proud of. But, you know, my dad actually used to come to Pride, and he would come to the rally, and... you know, so we're at the Pride March. I was March chair this particular year, and he was with some PFLAG group from out on Long Island where he grew up. He stopped going to PFLAG meetings, by the way, because he said, why do they cry all the time? And I said, well, Dad, not everybody is as thrilled that their kids are gay as you are. And he's like, oh, that's so weird. I'm not going to go. This is boring. I said, don't go. But my friend George, who I worked on Pride with forever, was a section leader for the parent section. And he comes racing down Fifth Avenue. It's the morning of the march. It hasn't even stepped up yet. He says, Janice, your dad is back there. He's panting. He says, he wants to talk to you. And I said, you're kidding, right? My dad found you? He doesn't even know George. He just thought, well, you've got a clipboard. You must be in charge. And I said, George, can you just run back there and tell him I'll talk to him after the event? I really don't have time right now. He said, okay. And he ran all the way back. And he did the same thing to me at the rally. Like he was sitting in a chair on an aisle, you know, in the grass, and somebody in a volunteer's t-shirt walked by, and he literally reached up and grabbed their t-shirt and tugged on it until they turned around. He said, I'm Janice Tom's father. Can you find her for me? It's like Jewish geography, except the gay version. It was amazing. So he was all about it, which was great. And I think my mom would have been too. She just missed it. But, you know, one of the things that was clear when we were growing up is that being different is actually better. And I think that that has stood me in good stead, because I believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really incredible.
Yeah. It is kind of incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, my brother is gay, too. So, my parents totally batted 1,000. Right. We both like girls. Well, actually, that's not true. He doesn't. He was straight for, well, he wasn't straight for a while. He wasn't out. And he was dating women like crazy, and I think at some point he went, why am I doing this? You're lovely and I'm not enjoying any of this. Yeah. But he's a cool guy.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is it like to have a gay sibling, and are your timeline similar?
He's 2 years younger, so okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know what it's like to have a straight sibling. I mean, there was a moment when I thought I did. And so does she. But what's really interesting is, you know, I came out pretty late, mm-hmm. relatively. And I think when he was in high school, certainly when he was in college, you know, by the time I was like a senior in college and he was attempting not to flunk out of his sophomore year again, he's so smart but not a student. So he was living at home because he was going to community college and I was up in Binghamton. And he must have overheard my parents talking about the fact that they were sure I was gay. And they probably weren't thrilled. Like, why would you be thrilled that your kid is part of a group that gets beaten up all the time? You know, really, when you want your kids to be happy. And they're old enough that being gay could actually mean you won't be happy. You'll be lonely, all those, like, spinster stories. So he overheard all this, and he told me this later. He thought to himself, I am not coming out ever. Ever. I'm not coming out ever. And he did. And in fact, I think he brought his first boyfriend, who I never met, and it was like truly like a 6-month thing, to have dinner with my father. And this kid was a Republican. And my father, who will say anything to anybody, listened to why. You know, he was a Reagan Republican. It's all about money. And my father turned to him while the three of them were sitting at dinner and said, so how suicidal are you? And I think Eric dated him for another 2 days. It was pretty much over. But, I know both my parents would be proud of us, and I know my father was, because I had the chance to live through it with him.
That's really incredible.
Yeah, it is kind of incredible.
They were ahead of their time.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, part of it was my dad grew up here. And, you know, he'd be 100 if he was still alive. He was born in 1919.
Wow.
So, and he was a child of immigrants. His second language was English. He didn't speak English until he went to school. Because he didn't need to. Because he lived in a little shtetl up in East Harlem, which was then very Jewish and is now Spanish. And his parents owned a store. So everybody, he met all kinds of people. And then they were both in the army, where you're thrown together with all kinds of people. And I realize that people go through exactly those experiences and end up being conservative idiots who hate everybody who doesn't look and act just like them. and treat people who don't look and act just like them badly. I realize that that happens a lot, or we wouldn't have Trump in office. But you can also do something much better with it, and they did that. And that's what they taught us. You know, I mean, I consider my brother and I their legacy. Yeah. And, you know, neither of us had kids, which is fine. I don't think either of us should have, but, you know, we've taught people, and we've, you know, I did Pride. I mean, think of all the people I had the opportunity to change their lives because they had that one day on Fifth Avenue where they could think, my whole life could be like this. My whole life could be like this. You know, in Stonewall 25, as hard as it was, the year after that, the couple years after that, there were suddenly thousands of little prides all over the planet. Over the planet. And, you know, in places like Tokyo, that was their first pride. Like 96, 97, because of this, or Idaho Falls, right? So, you know, that's a wonderful thing.
Inspiring millions of young LGBT people.
Yep, I hope so. It'd be nice to think that.
I'm sure it's true. So we were talking a little bit before this more formal interview about HIV and AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And what you were doing in that time period. So can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I worked on the first 800 line, which was HIV and AIDS. And, you know, there were some idiotic questions that were asked. Like, this was when they had decided it was gay people and Haitians. That's who got AIDS. That was it. Nobody else could possibly get it. And it was also the summer when Haitian cotton was a very popular upholstery fabric. It was a fad. And we had a woman who called and said, I have this Haitian cotton couch that I just got, what should I do with it? And I told her to throw it out because it was such an absurd question, I wanted her to lose the couch. And we had people who called and said, you know, my elderly father is being taken care of by a Haitian nurse, what should I do? I mean, the lack of information and the overwhelming fear, you know, there would be men mostly in hospitals in St. Vincent's. And the nurses wouldn't go in. They would leave the food at the door on a tray on the floor. And these were people who could not get out of bed. You know, they were grown men who, like, weighed 75 pounds. They couldn't get out of bed. It turned out that I had a great facility for writing obituaries. I wrote a lot of them. Because there were people who were involved with Pride, which was also my social circle, who were older than me. And they were dying. And, you know, I can remember going to four or five, if not funerals, at least, you know, memorial services for men who died of AIDS. I have friends who are just a little older than me who, you know, this is back in the days when you had a paper address book, right? It wasn't your phone. It was like a little book. And her book, she would, you know, put a little, like, flower or something next every time somebody died. And I know, I'm sure she still has it. There was no one left in the book. Everybody that she had planned to, like, be an old dyke with died. Her entire circle of friends died. There's like two or three guys left. My friend Franklin, he's my closest friend, his partner, and you didn't develop HIV then, you got AIDS and you died. And women especially, they didn't even get HIV, they got AIDS and they died, that was it. Because nobody believed that women got it. And because nobody cares about women anyway, right, in the first place, and many of the women who got it were sex workers, and so really, and probably weren't white, so really, who cares at all? So they just died. But, you know, lots of memorial services, and the thing that people your age never saw, and I hope we'll never see, is Christopher Street being filled with literally the walking dead. These guys would waste away to, like, you know, 100 pounds, like a grown man is 100 pounds. And they didn't, people lost their apartments. You know, you could walk down the streets of the West Village, which was really gay then, it's not that gay anymore. And there'd be, on garbage day, there'd be like piles of possessions out.
Wow.
Because one partner would die. Marriage didn't exist, right? We had, like, no legal protections. One partner would die. His parents would might take the body, might not, right? Might want to have nothing to do with him now that it turns out he's gay, which they found out because he has AIDS. And if the apartment was in his name, they'd boot the part his surviving widow out, and all their stuff would go down the street. Yeah, I mean, that happened over and over. That's what happened. That was the drill. Lots of times at hospitals, lots of times in churches, and you know, things like ACT UP. I had my differences. I had my differences with ACT UP, but without them, many more people would be dead. We wouldn't have PrEP, and we also wouldn't have a resistance movement. I mean, you know, when I said that changed the movement, it made lesbians more a part of the movement, because, you know, the trope about if it wasn't for lesbians, all these guys would have died. Yeah, when the nurses wouldn't go in or the doctors wouldn't go in, we did. Mm-hmm. And we fed people, and we washed them, and, you know, we put quarters on their eyes. Now, men did that too, right? Mm-hmm. Men took care of we all took care of our family. But it was the first time I think lesbians and gay men really had to work together. We had no choice. Because mm-hmm. we were all we had. Yeah, nobody needs to see that again. And nobody needs to forget it.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
So when you say that it changed our movement, like what exactly do you mean?
Well, I mean, groups like ACT UP mm-hmm. taught us how to resist. You know, they took, and certainly they took lessons from the civil rights movement and the women's movement. Right, so all of these movements came together. I mean, it's in the early, late 60s, all of those movements came together. The anti-war movement, the women's movement, the black civil rights movement, and the gay rights movement all came together. It's not a myth. That's one of the reasons Stonewall Riots happened. Also because Judy Garland died. Also because we were just fucking tired of taking it. But all of those movements informed each other. That energy, especially in this country, it all informed each other. And things like ACT UP taught the rest of the queer world, or what was then the gay world, how to resist and how to come together to create something, to change the FDA, to change the CDC, and to change how we take care of each other, to change how hospitals work, to change how funeral homes work, to change how to get out information about illnesses. You know, this whole anti-vax thing now is preposterous. And what it needs is an ACT UP to fix it, right? Because a bunch of sweet parents aren't going to fix it. Mm-hmm. You know, PFLAG came out of all of this too, right? Because some mom got really pissed off that that Morty was getting beat up. And so she started it in her living room, right? That's what starts things. Like, it has to happen. We can't just let we can't let our brothers die. So I think it changed the movement because it allowed gay people to realize that we did have power. All we had to do was take it. You know, all we had to do was take it. You chain yourself to a truck in front of the FDA enough times, they might listen. You know, or you throw your boyfriend's coffin over the fence in the White House so his ashes go all over the grass, they might listen. So that's why I think I think the movement would be utterly different. I don't know if we'd be as far as we are or not. We might be, but it would have been an utterly different trajectory. And, you know, I mean, the guys in ACT UP taught us all something. And sometimes we didn't want to listen. I mean, Larry Kramer is an annoying person to listen to, but good for him. If he hadn't existed, you and I might not be sitting here, honestly.
So, to wrap up, mm-hmm. what advice from all of your years of experience would you look back and give your teenage self?
My teenage self?
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a cliche, but it gets better.
Yeah.
You know, someday you're going to be able to pick out your own clothes. nobody's going to be allowed to dress you anymore. It will be such a relief. Wow, I don't know. I mean, I really do think it's going to be okay. Not even that it gets better, that you're fine. And you're going to find out how good you are as you get older. And it's going to be fine. You're going to find other people like you. And other people aren't anything like you, who you're going to adore and will love you. Yeah, I think that's it.
Thank you for making a space for me and millions of people to be as queer as we want to be.
And you're going to keep doing it, which is so exciting to me. Makes me feel very old, but it's very exciting to me.
Probably.
Janice Tom, I'm 63 years old. Today is April 25th, 2019, and we're in New York, New York. And I am recording this with my colleague, Reese.
I'm Reese Rathjen. I'm 31 years old. Today is April 25th, 2019. We're in New York, New York, and I'm recording this with my colleague, Janice Tom. All right, so tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
I was born in Ohio, southern Ohio. We lived in a little town called Chillicothe, which was too small to have a hospital, so I was born in Waverly. My dad was working for the Atomic Energy Commission at the Goodyear Power Plant. And the summer I turned 5, we moved back, for my parents, back east, because my dad is a native New Yorker and my mom grew up in Connecticut. And grew up really in a very small town on the north shore of Long Island.
Okay. And what was it like to kind of start to understand yourself as a lesbian growing up there?
Well, you know, I didn't. I think that I was aware early on that like something was different, which I think most queer kids will tell you. But I didn't come out even to myself until, I'm going to say, this is going to sound a little pathetic, but probably graduate school. So I was away from home for college.
Mm-hmm.
Went to college in upstate New York. And then lived at home for a year in between figuring out what I was doing next. And then went to library school. I have a master's in library science from UNC Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that being that far away from home, being a little older, it gives you a certain kind of freedom, even in your own mind, maybe especially in your own mind. And I met queer people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, librarianship is pretty queer. My dad is a librarian, so it's not completely queer, but it's a pretty queer profession. And that was the point I was certainly closeted, but I started to come out to myself. And then, you know, my first job after library school was actually back in North Carolina. Like, I moved all the way back to New York and ended up moving back to Charlotte, where I worked for IBM, where I was certainly in the closet. That was not safe, and I was that smart. But then ended up in a job in New York,
mm-hmm.
and moved to Park Slope, Brooklyn, which then was a pretty beat-up neighborhood that was being revitalized by lesbians who were buying these really cheap, I mean really cheap, townhouses that were falling down and renovating them. And so there's a reason it was called Dyke Slope, because we basically homesteaded the whole place and started having babies. And you know, anywhere gay people go is suddenly too nice and they have to move out because it gets too expensive. I mean, it happens in artist communities all over the world, right? That's what happened to here to Soho. So living in Park Slope really allowed me to be out, at least in my non-work life. I was
mm-hmm.
working at banks and brokerage firms, and this, I'm old enough, and that was long enough ago, that being out at work was not a possibility.
What years was that?
That would have been the mid-80s.
Okay.
Yeah, and it just, you know, it was cool to walk around holding your girlfriend's hand on those, like, 5 blocks in Park Slope.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I worked for great big Fortune 10, Fortune 25 companies, financial companies. And I wore a suit and skirt and heels and hose to work every day. I loved those jobs. They were great jobs, but they were not jobs where it was safe to be out. So I wasn't.
Yeah, how long did you work in those kind of environments?
That's really interesting. Overall, I think the whole bank and brokerage firm thing was probably 10 or 15 years. I was a librarian. I was a special librarian. And that was back when people realized that not all information was on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And this didn't, you know, not everything on the internet is actually true. And so people actually had researchers do research. They could, you know, make good investments. That doesn't exist anymore. She says with some annoyance. So yeah, and then had a couple of like really weird jobs. So they were research jobs, but they were basically boiler room jobs.
Uh-huh.
It's like people have gave us so much money. All these big companies gave us a retainer every month, and they could call up and ask any question they wanted. And we had to go get the answer.
Okay.
It was a very strange job. But, you know, you could be whatever. You could have nearly come to work naked there as long as you answered the questions. They really didn't care. So that was the point at which I started having some gay friends at work, and slowly started to, you know, come out. I could at least be out of work.
Yeah.
And, you know, went from there to AMFAR, to the American Foundation for AIDS Research, where, you know, AIDS is not a gay disease, but it was certainly okay to be out at AMFAR.
Uh-huh.
And this is really collapsing my work life, but, you know, got hired away from there to the task force,
mm-hmm.
where actually being out at work is perfectly all right.
I would hope so.
Yeah, exactly. Gay for pay.
And I know that you did a lot with
Pride.
With New York Pride over
yeah.
the years. Was that overlapping with your
yes.
time working in those more
yes.
conservative?
Yeah, it actually was.
Yeah.
There wasn't a huge overlap. Most of that happened after I got out of sort of the banking industry.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is that the first gay, really gay thing I did was I volunteered for what was in the National Gay Task Force,
mm-hmm.
When it was headquartered here in New York. At 85th Avenue, and we had the first 800 number, first gay 800 number of any kind, probably in the world, but certainly in the country. And it was specifically an AIDS hotline,
mm-hmm.
and it was when AIDS was called GRID, stood for gay-related immune deficiency.
Mm.
And people would call in. It was mostly at night, and there were like five stations. I was usually the only woman. And people would call in with questions that, you know, now sort of blow my mind. And we had answers that were terrible, but they were the best answers we had. Like, if you're not promiscuous, you're safe. Well, that's not true, but it certainly seemed like it then.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'd have people, but because we were the only 800 number, we'd also have kids calling in from phone booths in the middle of Florida saying, I came out and my parents kicked me out of the house, I don't know what to do.
Wow.
And they'd be like standing there with a quarter. And, you know, so we, you know, we'd find like some MCC in Palmetto, Florida, and say, there's this kid standing in a phone booth, can you go get him?
Wow.
And they would. So some of it had nothing to do with AIDS because we were it. We were the only thing there was. And I actually met my first girlfriend there. And when we broke up, we had friends on Staten Island in this organization called the Staten Island Lesbian Connection, which was silk. We thought that was so cool. And we marched in Pride one year. And this was when Pride ended at the river, and the rally was at the end of the march, which hasn't been true forever, and it's not true at all now. And you couldn't hear the rally, because the sound system was like, I don't know, a tin can with a string. And they called because I was one of the marshals, and they said, do you want to come to the thank you party? I said, no, I don't, but you know, your sound system sucks. They said, would you like to work on it? I said, sure. And that is precisely how I got involved with Pride. I worked on the rally and ended up on the board for almost 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing. I was actually the president of an organization that's now called InterPride, which then was called the International Association of Lesbian and Gay Pride Coordinators, which are all the pride organizations around the country and now around the world.
Wow.
And which is where I saw the quilt, because we moved our national conference to Baltimore in 1987. It was
mm-hmm.
supposed to be, I think, in St. Louis.
The year I was born, for some
intergenerational
context.
I'm going to stab myself. And that was, they had the whole quilt out, and it literally covered them all.
Wow.
It literally covered them all. And, you know, you kind of came out of the noise and raucousness of, you know, the march and a zillion queer people being in one place and all the gay bands and all the gay choruses. And you walked into this huge open public space, open to the sky. I mean, it's not a building, it's a park. And it was as quiet as it could be. And it was covered with dust. And it was astonishing. And I think now I know what I was looking at, but I really don't think I knew what I was looking at, because I was kind of, it was 87. I was still pretty young. And I hadn't yet had a friend who died.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of friends who weren't feeling well, and we weren't really sure why. But I didn't have any friends who had died yet, so it didn't make any sense to me, and because I didn't have anyone on the quilt yet. Now I do. But so it didn't make any sense to me, and I remember thinking, this is huge. I'm not really sure what this is, and then I went off and did something else. I have to admit, I did not pay enough attention to it. In 93, at that march, I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I was a member of, I don't know if they call it this anymore, but Heritage of Pride, from probably 86
mm-hmm.
to, I'm going to guess, 96 or 97, and held a bunch of positions on the board. I was co-chair three times because they fooled me. They didn't tell me that I was taking over someone's term, and I wasn't smart enough to figure that out. I was march chair for 3 years. That's the best job in the world. It is the best job in the world. To be able to stand and, I mean, to be able to put something like that together for everyone, because the deal is that here's the street, here are the toilets, you're in this order because that's what we think makes sense. After that, don't hurt anyone. Have a good time. We're going to try and keep you moving so the march doesn't take 7 hours. But, you know, be the biggest fag, the biggest fairy, the biggest butch you want to be. Be as trans as you want to be. Be whatever it is you want to do. Enjoy yourself, right? This is the one day where nobody's going to bother you. It's kind of like creating change.
Yeah.
Like, be it was the essence of be you. And, you know, to be able to be involved with a group of volunteers, because it's all volunteers, to make something that affirming happen, I could never regret a minute of it. And in 94, we did it. I think New York Pride did a dumb thing, and I think that they would admit it now, that
mm-hmm.
kind of gave away two parts of Pride to this nascent organization called Stonewall 25,
mm-hmm.
which I think got its 501c3 like moments before June of 94. And so the march and the rally that year weren't done by Heritage of Pride.
They did
the dance and took the opportunity to do it for two nights and made a boatload of money, which is great because that money carried us through for a couple of years, because it was a little dicey after that, because it's like, well, we just did this big thing and who are you people again? Right? And we did the Pride Festival, which I think was also much bigger and might have gone for 2 days. I don't remember anymore. But Stonewall 25, I was the representative from InterPride. But also as a New Yorker and as somebody who'd worked on Pride for a long time, a lot of the folks who were involved in it came in to work on it
mm-hmm.
from all over the country, which was great, but they had no idea what they were doing. I mean, to the point where they thought we could march up to the UN and make a right. And I'm like, you can't actually do that. You'll get really wet. and I don't think they're going to let all of us walk around the grounds of the UN. This was long before 9/11. You can't just like walk around the UN. Plus, it's not that big. He said, oh, we could meet in Doc Hammarskjöld Plaza. I'm like, it's like the size of your living room. We're going to have 2 million people here. You won't be able to fit anything but the lead banner in there. So there was a lot of that. A lot of, you know, New York realness had to be delivered. So I worked on that, and it was a bunch of amateurs. There was no fundraising. But this is also when the only sponsors a queer thing could get was like beer and cigarettes or liquor and cigarettes. And we wouldn't take cigarette money. You know, one of the first sponsorships I got at Heritage of Pride was from Bud, right? And they gave me a check for $10,000, and I thought this was the most money we'd ever have. I thought it was astonishing. So, Stonewall 25 sponsors there weren't any.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were building the rally stage on the Great Lawn, and we had, you know, a big professional company doing it, and every once in a while they'd just quit because we couldn't pay him.
Wow.
And, you know, we'd scramble for 3 or 4 hours and, like, scrape up whatever it was they needed to get going again. And they quit again. I didn't think we were going to have a rally because I didn't think, like, the sound was going to be up.
Wow.
And it was this massive concert stage because the Great Lawn is huge, which is why they call it that. So we filled Fifth Avenue. There was actually a counter march. The Stonewall 25 march actually went by the UN. It went down First Avenue,
mm-hmm.
up First Avenue. To the Great Lawn,
mm-hmm.
and there was a counter march because they didn't want to go past the UN. Of course there was, and I think there's going to be one this year too that went up Fifth, to the Great Lawn, and they just met at the Great Lawn. And it was actually fun. The folks who were working on the official march were actually, the New Yorkers were totally cool with the march on Fifth Avenue. It's like, yeah, we'd actually rather be there.
Mm-hmm.
So good, take up the space, keep the space for us, we'll be back. And yeah, that was an amazing thing. And it, you know, it ended deeply in the red. It ended with all of these people we owed money to. And you know, we ended up just declaring bankruptcy.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, my friend Franklin, who was one of the national co-chairs at the age of 29, I think he ended up losing, I mean, this doesn't sound like a big deal now, but he ended up losing his American Express card because we had put like everything on it and he couldn't pay it. And so American Express took it away. So stuff like that happened.
Wow.
Yeah. It was kind of amazing. But, you know, after that, went back to working on Pride. I was the chair for the Dance on the Pier for 3 years. I was the person who started the Women's Dance on the Pier, which used to be called Rapture. I think they've renamed it.
Mm-hmm. When did you start that?
Oh, man. I don't even know. It would have been maybe 90. Feels like it might have been... No, that can't be right. It's almost 25. Huh. It must have been, like, 96 or 97. Sound right? Yeah, that might be right. Because the last thing I did as a board member was the dance, and I did it for 3 years because, again, they fooled me. I'm like, no, we'll get somebody to do it. And nobody wanted to do it. I'm like, all right, I'll do it again. You know, and while the march, I think, was the most meaningful thing I did, you know, to be able to say, well, at one time in my life, I actually got to say go and all these fireworks lit up the sky. That's pretty cool. Not many people get to say that. You know, and I got to get Janet Jackson on stage, and, you know, I got to get, now I can't think of her name, Jennifer Lopez up on stage. She is about 37 pounds wringing wet.
Wow.
You just can't imagine how tiny she is. So, you know, it made all those boys happy. So that's the Pride, that's a short tour of the Pride thing.
So, your life has been a lot of different things.
Yes.
Yeah. What did you imagine as a young librarian that your life would be?
Not this.
And how is it different?
That's really interesting. You know, one of the things I wanted to do when I was in library school is be president of the American Library Association, which is the professional association. One of them. There are several. And I rapidly realized that that wasn't actually all that interesting to me. For one thing, it was always men. Now, not true anymore, which is really fascinating because most, like the vast majority of librarians are women,
mm-hmm.
or female identified people. But if you look at big library systems, like big cities or huge universities, or things like the American Library System, all the people who are running those are guys.
Wow.
And most of them don't have library degrees, they have MBAs, which I could see that being useful, but they don't have library degrees. And I could get off on a whole thing about how unfair that is. But I didn't imagine this. Now, my family was very invested in what we now call social justice, what they would have called civil rights. And so I was brought up with that. During the Vietnam War, my dad went to Washington every month to march. And he wanted to take me, and my mother said, I think she's a little young, which was probably true. I don't think he could have managed like a 12-year-old who needed to pee. when he was with all his buddies. But so that was important. You know, my first sort of piece of political knowledge had to do with Pete Seeger, who was one of my family's icons, that he wasn't allowed to perform. He'd been blacklisted. And the reason was that he was a communist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he testified in front of the Joe McCarthy's commission, and he wouldn't answer any questions. He said, they'll sing for you. So, you know, that, I grew up with that, you know, and I grew up with stories about people like Paul Robeson and Leadbelly and Martin Luther King and Elizabeth Cotton and people who were part of the culture of the civil rights movement and the culture of this country, because my parents were all both first generation Americans. So all of the fact that I ended up doing this kind of social justice work and got to it through Pride, it's a surprise, but it's really not. And, you know, my mother passed away before I got involved with Pride, and actually while I was still working for banks, which, you know, they were both proud of. But, you know, my dad actually used to come to Pride, and he would come to the rally, and, you know, so we're at the Pride March. I was March chair this particular year, and he was with some PFLAG group from out on Long Island where he grew up. He stopped going to PFLAG meetings, by the way, because he said, "Why do they cry all the time?" And I said, "Well, Dad, not everybody is as thrilled that their kids are gay as you are." And he's like, "Oh, that's so weird. I'm not going to go. This is boring." I said, "Don't go." But my friend George, who I worked on Pride with forever, was a section leader for the parent section. And he comes racing down Fifth Avenue. It's the morning of the march. It hasn't even stepped up yet. He says, Janice, your dad is back there. He's panting. He says, he wants to talk to you. And I said, you're kidding, right? My dad found you? He doesn't even know George. He just thought, well, you've got a clipboard. You must be in charge. And I said, George, can you just run back there and tell him I'll talk to him after the event? I really don't have time right now. He said, okay. And he ran all the way back. And he did the same thing to me at the rally. Like he was sitting in a chair on an aisle, you know, in the grass, and somebody in a volunteer's t-shirt walked by, and he literally reached up and grabbed their t-shirt and tugged on it until they turned around. He said, "I'm Janice Tom's father. Can you find her for me?" It's like Jewish geography, except the gay version. It was amazing. So he was all about it, which was great. And I think my mom would have been too. She just missed it. But, you know, one of the things that was clear when we were growing up is that being different is actually better. And I think that has stood me in good stead, because I believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really incredible.
Yeah. It is kind of incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, my brother is gay, too. My parents totally batted 1,000. Right. We both like girls. Well, actually, that's not true. He doesn't. He wasn't straight for a while. He wasn't out. And he was dating women like crazy, and I think at some point he went, why am I doing this? You're lovely and I'm not enjoying any of this. Yeah, but he's a cool guy.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is it like to have a gay sibling, and like, well, are your timeline similar?
He's 2 years younger, so okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know what it's like to have a straight sibling. I mean, there was a moment when I thought I did, and so does she. But what's really interesting is, you know, I came out pretty late, mm-hmm. relatively. And I think when he was in high school, certainly when he was in college, you know, by the time I was like a senior in college and he was attempting not to flunk out of his sophomore year again, he's so smart but not a student. So he was living at home because he was going to community college and I was up in Binghamton. And he must have overheard my parents talking about the fact that they were sure I was gay. And they probably weren't thrilled. Like, why would you be thrilled that your kid is part of a group that's gets beaten up all the time? You know, really, when you want your kids to be happy. And they're old enough that being gay could actually mean you won't be happy. You'll be lonely, all those, like, spinster stories. So he overheard all this, and he told me this later. He thought to himself, I am not coming out ever. Ever. I'm not coming out ever. And he did. And in fact, I think he brought his first boyfriend, who I never met, it was like truly like a 6-month thing, to have dinner with my father. And this kid was a Republican. And my father, who will say anything to anybody, listened to why. You know, he was a Reagan Republican. It's all about money. And my father turned to him while the three of them were sitting at dinner and said, "So how suicidal are you?" And I think Eric dated him for another 2 days. It was pretty much over. But, you know, I know both my parents would be proud of us, and I know my father was, because I had the chance to live through it with him.
That's really incredible.
Yeah, it is kind of incredible.
They were ahead of their time.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, part of it was my dad grew up here. And, you know, he'd be 100 if he was still alive. He was born in 1919.
Wow.
So, and he was a child of immigrants. His second language was English. He didn't speak English until he went to school, because he didn't need to, because he lived in a little shtetl up in East Harlem, which was then very Jewish and is now Spanish. And his parents owned a store. So everybody, he met all kinds of people. And then they were both in the army. where you're thrown together with all kinds of people. And I, you know, I realize that people go through exactly those experiences and end up being conservative idiots who hate everybody who doesn't look and act just like them and treat people who don't look and act just like them badly. I realize that that happens a lot, or we wouldn't have Trump in office. But you can also do something much better with it, and they did that. And they, that's what they taught us. You know, I mean, I consider my brother and I their legacy. Yeah. And, you know, neither of us had kids, which is fine. I don't think either of us should have. But, you know, we've taught people. And we've, you know, I did Pride. I mean, think of all the people I had the opportunity to change their lives. Because they had that one day on Fifth Avenue where they could think, my whole life could be like this. My whole life could be like this. You know, in Stonewall 25, as hard as it was, the year after that, a couple years after that, there were suddenly thousands of little prides all over the planet. And, you know, in places like Tokyo. That was their first pride, like 96, 97. Because of this. Or Idaho Falls, right? So, you know, that's a wonderful thing.
Inspiring millions of young LGBT people.
Yep. I hope so. It'd be nice to think that.
I'm sure. I'm sure it's true. So we were talking a little bit before this more formal interview about HIV and AIDS and what you were doing in that time period. So can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I worked on the first 800 line, which was HIV and AIDS. And, you know, there were some idiotic questions that were asked. Like, this was when they had decided it was gay people and Haitians. That's who got AIDS. That was it. Nobody else could possibly get it. And it was also the summer when Haitian cotton was a very popular upholstery fabric. It was a fad. And we had a woman who called and said, I have this Haitian cotton couch that I just got. What should I do with it? And I told her to throw it out because it was such an absurd question. I wanted her to lose the couch. And we had people who called and said, you know, my elderly father is being taken care of by a Haitian nurse. What should I do? I mean, the lack of information and the overwhelming fear. You know, there would be men mostly in hospitals in St. Vincent's, and the nurses wouldn't go in. They would leave the food at the door on a tray on the floor. And these were people who could not get out of bed. You know, they were grown men who, like, weighed 75 pounds. They couldn't get out of bed. It turned out that I had a great facility for writing obituaries. I wrote a lot of them. Because there were people who were involved with Pride, which was also my social circle, who were older than me. And they were dying. And, you know, I can remember going to four or five, if not funerals, at least, you know, memorial services for men who died of AIDS. I have friends who are just a little older than me who, you know, this is back in the days when you had a paper address book, right? It wasn't your phone. It was like a little book. And her book, she would, you know, put a little, like, flower or something next every time somebody died. And I know, I'm sure she still has it. There was no one left in the book. Everybody that she had planned to, like, be an old dyke with died. Her entire circle of friends died. There's like two or three guys left. My friend Franklin, he's my closest friend, his partner, and you didn't develop HIV then, you got AIDS and you died. And women especially, they didn't even get HIV, they got AIDS and they died, that was it. Because nobody believed that women got it. And because nobody cares about women anyway, right, in the first place. And many of the women who got it were sex workers. And so really, and probably weren't white, so really, who cares at all? So they just died. But, you know, lots of memorial services. And the thing that people your age never saw, and I hope we'll never see, is Christopher Street being filled with literally the walking dead. These guys would waste away to, like, you know, 100 pounds, like a grown man is 100 pounds. And they didn't, people lost their apartments. You know, you could walk down the streets of the West Village, which was really gay then, it's not that gay anymore. And there'd be, on garbage day, there'd be like piles of possessions out.
Wow.
Because One partner would die. Marriage didn't exist, right? We had like no legal protections. One partner would die. His parents would might take the body, might not, right? Might want to have nothing to do with him now that it turns out he's gay, which they found out because he has AIDS. And the apartment was in his name. They'd boot his surviving widow out, and all their stuff would go down the street. That happened over and over. That's what happened. That was the drill. Lots of times at hospitals, lots of times in churches, and you know, things like ACT UP. I had my differences. I had my differences with ACT UP, but without them, many more people would be dead. We wouldn't have PrEP, and we also wouldn't have a resistance movement. When I said that changed the movement, it made lesbians more a part of the movement, because, you know, the trope about if it wasn't for lesbians, all these guys would have died. Yeah, when the nurses wouldn't go in or the doctors wouldn't go in, we did. Mm-hmm. And we fed people, and we washed them, and, you know, we put quarters on their eyes. Now, men did that too, right? Mm-hmm. Men took care of we all took care of our family. But it was the first time I think lesbians and gay men really had to work together. We had no choice. Because mm-hmm. we were all we had. Yeah, it was, nobody needs to see that again. And nobody needs to forget it.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
So when you say that it changed our movement, like what exactly do you mean?
Well, I mean, groups like ACT UP mm-hmm. taught us how to resist. You know, they took, and certainly they took lessons from the civil rights movement and the women's movement, right? So all of these movements came together. I mean, it's in the late 60s, all of those movements came together. The anti-war movement, the women's movement, the black civil rights movement, and the gay rights movement all came together. It's not a myth. That's one of the reasons Stonewall riots happened. Also because Judy Garland died. Also because we were just fucking tired of taking it. But all of those movements informed each other. That energy, especially in this country, it all informed each other. And things like ACT UP taught the rest of the queer world, or what was then the gay world, how to resist and how to come together to create something. To change the FDA, to change the CDC, and to change how we take care of each other, to change how hospitals work, to change how funeral homes work, to change how to get out information about illnesses. You know, this whole anti-vax thing now is preposterous, and what it needs is an ACT UP to fix it, right? Because a bunch of sweet parents aren't gonna fix it. You know, PFLAG came out of all of this too, right? Because some mom got really pissed off that they weren't, that Morty was getting beat up. And so she started it in her living room, right? That's what starts things. Like, it has to happen. We can't just let this, we can't let our brothers die. So I think it changed the movement because it allowed gay people to realize that we did have power. All we had to do is take it. You know, all we had to do is take it. You chain yourself to a truck in front of the FDA enough times, they might listen. You know, or you throw your boyfriend's coffin over the fence in the White House so his ashes go all over the grass, they might listen. So that's why I think I think the movement would be utterly different. I don't know if we'd be as far as we are or not. We might be, but it would have been an utterly different trajectory. And, you know, I mean, the guys in ACT UP taught us all something. And sometimes we didn't want to listen. I mean, Larry Kramer is an annoying person to listen to, but good for him. If he hadn't existed, you and I might not be sitting here, honestly.
Yeah. So, to wrap up,
mm-hmm.
what advice from all of your years of experience would you look back and give your teenage self?
My teenage self?
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a cliche, but it gets better.
Yeah.
Someday you're going to be able to pick out your own clothes. nobody's going to be allowed to dress you anymore. It will be such a relief. I don't know. I mean, I really do think it's going to be okay. Not even that it gets better, that you're fine. And you're going to find out how good you are as you get older. And it's going to be fine. You're going to find other people like you. And other people aren't anything like you, who you're going to adore and will love you. Yeah, I think that's it.
Well, thank you for making a space for me and millions of people to be as queer as we want to be.
And you're going to keep doing it, which is so exciting to me. Makes me feel very old, but it's very exciting to me.